anything to say or ask? Trey.
I was just curious about something about your practice. May I ask?
Sure. Maybe a little louder so they can hear. I might not answer, but.
I think that you started your practice in the Bodh Gaya circuit, which I've heard many humorous and stories about the Bodh Gaya days, and I feel privileged to have met here and in other places some of the Bodh Gaya people. But I have the sense that, you know, it was all quite rigorous and the conditions were challenging, and although there was so much healing, there was like this small element of endurance as well with it all, which might be wrong, but that's kind of within the humour what I got. So I was just curious, at what point did you learn that softness and gentleness and slowness could be just as healing and just as fruitful as sitting and getting up at 4:30 and sitting bolt upright for 12 hours a day? Like, what happened to make you learn there is another way?
So, first of all, going back that far, as I said, Bodh Gaya was a village then. And there wasn't sort of cappuccino across the street or whatever. Anywhere. Probably not even in Delhi. So it's all relative, but for some people, it wasn't just a tiny element of endurance. On the other hand, for me, it's through what I find more demanding practice of gentleness and allowing the power to rise and move me. That is when I get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and do my practice. Whereas in Bodh Gaya, it was easily an element of, at the same time, the incredible loveliness of the night air and the frogs and the stillness and the mosquitoes. As all part of it and together. But because of that element, sometimes of endurance added to what could have just been such a lovely meditation, not counting how long am I staying. Because of the element of pushing, as if I should, the longer I push, the better. The longer I stay awake, meditating in the hall after the schedule has ended with the mosquitoes. Each time someone leaves the hall, more mosquitoes per person. And we all had our ways, you know, with a shawl that you have to cover everything, but you had to be able to breathe, of course, but that they couldn't get in. But if they did, then the endurance, etc. And the socks were important as well. Not that the mosquitoes didn't bite through socks, but then you could put on lots of mosquito repellent without it just getting absorbed through the skin straight into the bloodstream. So it's not where I started, though. So that I learned about the joyful leading edge for practice, maybe in childhood. And then I kept accidentally finding it when I would try to meditate from books before I went to Bodh Gaya. I would do what the book said. First things first, sit up, back straight, and then whatever it was, whatever the thing. And I would, and I didn't have a problem with sitting. Some people have that problem with sitting. But I would still just find myself, the more I got into the meditation, the more I went horizontal. And in my mind, therefore, I'm no longer meditating, but I was. So for me, the way it went was doing lots of those kinds of retreats. And because I also have the control freak vending machine installed, I felt very comfortable with the assumption that we have to put that pushing and enduring quality in order to get any results. And when my own experience showed me I didn't need that, I felt guilty. I felt like I was breaking the rules and doing the wrong thing. And so luckily I would break the rules and do the wrong thing. And I would go to my room and lie down and practice, at that time, loving kindness meditation. Fairly, you could say intensively, or we could say lovingly, I got into it. And then I met one of my main teachers, and like Pramaji was saying about her teacher, I learned about celebration and that there was no need to add the push to endure. There is a willingness. There's one psychologist who works with relationships. He's a sex psychologist, sex therapist for couples. And he talks about, this is going to sound weird, but he talks about meaningful endurance, and it doesn't mean so much about while having sex, but in the relationship, meaningful endurance. Which just means I'm letting love act instead of programming act. Instead of fear. There were also ways that I got hints that something maybe is broken or limited in the assumption that we have to force ourselves to endure. So on the very first guided retreat that I did, which was a two-day retreat, which was terrifying, 2 days of silence, also in Bodh Gaya, but not. It was with different teachers. And because the way I heard the teachings, I thought it was be perfectionist and push yourself really hard and use lots of criticism to get results of some kind. And also because there is in each of us, and there is in me a natural way of connecting also. And so that just was like a big collision. So there was lots of energy, connection with meditation, and trying to force that to fit this endurance model. And already in the very first meditation of my first retreat, at the age of 20, I passed out, flat on my face. And no one stood up and walked over to help me. I just woke up with my cheek on this old, scratchy carpet. I saw the teacher, who was a beautiful man. He's like shining like moonlight and everything. Looked a little bit like Gandhiji. He was about to stand up, and he saw me wake up, and he thought I was fine. And the meditation continued in silence until the bell rang. So that allowed me to have more fire in my question of where's the love? Or some other question that one might ask. Like, what? Someone else later told me that I provided her the opportunity to feel great compassion. When she heard that noise and gently opened her eyes and looked down upon me, she felt great compassion.
How long were you passed out?
How do I know? I was gone. Probably not long. Is that enough of an answer for now? I could just say maybe one more sort of line. After being then with one of my main teachers, Punjaji, for 6.5 years, I went back to Bodh Gaya to the retreats with Christopher and Sharda and Fred, and I think Norman was there also. And it was a totally different experience. So much fun. Because I had had enough practice, there was enough momentum in knowing I didn't need pushiness or aggression to fall into stillness and stay kind of humming with that vibration of life and letting that do its work, which would be some cleaning and some opening, offering, realizations. So that chance of finding our way, feeling our way towards the where we can kind of vibrate with what's important is one way to say it. At first, the quality is joy that helps us find that. And so to find the difference between the two kinds of joy. So joy because I got what I wanted or I got rid of what I didn't want. That's all right, but it's programming, it's a vending machine. And joy that just comes out of nowhere. I mean, they both come out of nowhere, kind of, but there's the unprogrammed joy where it's clear it's a gift. So maybe we could say I had had practice of receptivity of gift. and I had unpracticed. So I had stopped reinforcing that idea of pushing and trying to make myself fit a model rather than discovering what is this.
How did you then relate to the model? Because the model in Bodh Gaya hadn't changed. That model
I just had so much joy. I would sit and feel joy. And so maybe another example is then I had a terrible fear of speaking it. They had group interviews. You had to go to group interviews every other day. Imagine how much you'd plan what you were going to say the whole time, and then you'd go and you'd say that or something else, and then you'd think about, oh, why didn't I say that? Or, oh, I'm so glad, oh, shit, or whatever. So I was terrified, and so I think I skipped, and then maybe I went and I tried to be at the end because they would, you know, there wouldn't be enough time. And the teacher would be happy that I would just say something really short so that we could end on time, you know. And then somehow I was stupidly said how I was afraid of speaking in the interview group, in the group of Christopher. So stupid of me. So then, of course, Christopher said, so go to a group every day, which I could have not done. I could have just ignored that. There were 120 people who would, you know. But I did go. And in some ways it was unuseful in that I did find that there were questions that I had pretended not to have that then I did ask. And I didn't really actually get answers that satisfied me about some of my experiences. But it was important. It was helpful and important to ask it anyway, somehow, like to realize, oh, that's a question that could be asked. And it's not just stored in a package there. And also there was so this is where if we would try to make a rule or a model out of don't do or effortless, then we'll get off track. So from just humming with joy in the meditations, there was this fiery process of facing my fear of authority by going to those teachers that I had all kinds of ideas about. Them not being really human, kind of, basically. And I even went for a one-to-one with Christopher, only to go for the one-to-one with Christopher. And that was fine. And I even spoke in an inquiry in the hall, so that's 120 people, anyone, anytime. So that was good. And I remember someone who was on the retreat, kind of a friend, don't know him well, but feeling a friend. He was so perplexed. That means like he was really didn't get why, if I have these such deep meditations, why was I so frightened, so afraid to talk to a teacher? Because his experience was so different. That was helpful to realize that someone didn't have my experience. And I did, and it was okay. And later being in that form of it's not so strict compared to what it could be also. By the way, but there is that idea about that there's room for, that there's just as much room for toughness as for gentleness. There's that idea. And what I discovered was, the way I put it is the Dharma is in charge. So kind of leaving the power structures as they are, meetings that needed to happen, words that needed to come, it all could flow between all that structure anyway. The gentleness, the transformation, for that period of time, and then I got pregnant and never went back. Christopher and I both agreed that it was not, Bodgai was not a place for a one-year-old baby to spend a month with the pollution and all. What's important maybe is just being clear about what our survival strategies are. So what is our addiction? What is it that we're aiming for all the time? We're pointing in one or two directions all the time, trying something. And part of that addictive quality is the not noticing that it's not happening. We're trying to get approval, or we're trying to get rejection, space, whatever. We're trying to get up or down, whatever it is. And there's an inability in addiction to notice that there's not satisfaction. There's not rest. And then we don't know. Just like if you haven't been in silence, you don't know what it's like to be in silence. If you haven't been at rest, you don't know what it's like to be at rest. And especially nowadays. Now, every year, more and more, it could just be that the retreat is only come and hand in all your devices, or we'll just turn off the electricity. So even if you have, whatever, there's no way to have any device on. And that's all. That could be a retreat now. People go on retreat, and that's what they do. That's all they do. And they find it so helpful. And yet at home, we don't do that even for an hour. We don't just turn it off for an hour, usually. We think that could be a good idea. And usually we don't. So if we could notice that when we're in the programming, in the survival strategy, people call it survival strategy, and I like that term because if there's an sort of inclination, like a shift, a movement out of the programming, usually we're pretty sure we're going to die. Right? You're going to be killed or you're going to die somehow very soon. There's that much fear. Or there's that much blanking out or attack, whatever version of fear. It seems to our system that in order to survive, we first have to fill in the blank, whatever it is. Then we can rest, then we can live, then we could speak up, then we could stay quiet, whatever. Then we could be nice, then we could be firm, whatever. And love really needs all of those. It needs all of that full range to be firm and to be nice, etc. And so this is the subject of failure, which really I was using in a kind of joking way with Damon originally. Except that it is a very serious suggestion. It's sort of about really deadening the programming. But can you feel what your survival strategy is and what it feels like? It's not the most important thing, but it is a step that needs to happen, that we know what that is. We know that that is. And it's not your personal shame thing. Whatever you think your personal shame thing is, that's probably your thing. Your addiction.
Can you give some examples?
Well, I did. So, like wanting approval, for example, that's very common. It could be more like recognition, it could be more like confirmation, it could be more like admiration, it could be more like respect. So, almost, I want you to be afraid of me with respect, that flavor, for example.
So you mean in our general way we behave with people?
Behind everything. Yeah. We can say behind everything. It actually isn't all that's going on, of course. Otherwise, we wouldn't be alive. Because we're not machines. So Jacques Le Seurat talks about, at the end of describing his sensory experiences, and then he talks about that being so completely receptive to the trees that they come to him. And that any even curiosity, which sounds like such a positive thing, that even curiosity towards the tree puts him in a bubble where he can't feel them without huge effort. So this is where we could stay with that idea that, oh, by the huge effort I can feel the trees, and we keep pointing out towards the tree and feeling it and getting exhausted and feeling it and getting exhausted. Or we then discover, we let the discovery happen with only the effort of very rigorously not going towards the tree. So it's in a way more demanding. No response to the question, just quiet. Just stay, don't go. Just rest, don't act. Just letting the life act. I find that in the long run, it's much more demanding, but it sounds so easy.
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
I think that what makes it more difficult is the pressure to be joyful.
The pressure to be joyful.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. How horrible.
And I think an extreme manifestation of that is the thing of mindfulness, which I've experienced as so much pressure to be enjoying every moment
Okay.
and to be living in every moment and to be enjoying every cup of tea that I drink, that I, as I shared with you, I mean, I kind of rebelled against that and I hated it. But I think that it is part of a larger problem in New Age spirituality, the pressure to be joyful, and I really hate it. And I feel that as somebody who's judged myself a lot all throughout my life, I think, about various things, that this became another way of judging myself constantly, which is why I feel very grateful to you when you talk about openness. And it's a completely different approach, I think. It's, like there shouldn't be that pressure to go to the tree or make the tree come to you. So I really, have gratitude for that.
I think that originally it's one thing, but because of our conditioning to pressure and judge, exactly, we keep misunderstanding and doing mindfulness. And then that becomes as if that's the correct way of teaching it and doing it. And it's unsustainable. And so then the rebel is so important. Thank goodness we have that. Thank goodness. Then we have to come back to actually being interested in what is instead of what can I add to this? So that's exactly when I said failure the other day, it's that. It's the rebel also. It's like feeling, it's a feeling, an understand, a feeling, understanding, experience. This is unsustainable. It's a realization something's not quite right here. and I'm not interested in adding something. What am I interested in again? And so similarly, we feel that survival strategy of pressure and judge. And we just notice it doesn't go anywhere. And it hurts. And it is worth maybe getting inside the survival strategy. So I want approval or success or whatever. Why? So that it's not even I want, but there's the movement of putting pressure and judging. Why? Not why psychologically or in a story, but in that moment of feeling, oh, there's pressure and judge. What is that? What's the function of that? What's the function of that little wooden house that's just been stuck on top of life there? And so this is where in the meditation a couple days ago with forgiveness, about forgiveness, we tried, or I tried to bring up experimenting with really digging to understand how things happen, how hurt happens. That's what we can kind of work at that. We can work at understanding. That's not the same as trying to make forgiveness happen, but we can work at understanding. We can assume that understanding is possible, and that if there's some kind of friction, there's probably a communication gap. And we might be able to understand, and that would give a lot more leverage and shift. But I think that forgiveness, as we hopefully also kind of felt a bit in the meditation, is something else that I keep feeling is as if like a land. It's another land, another place. So it's not really literally a place, but a kind of place where maybe we're in touch with reality in the sense of what is. So this is survival strategy, and this is why survival strategy, this vulnerability. And there's the stream of life. And I think it has something to do with being a bit at home in our hips and pelvic bowl physically, that we can be here on the planet with our vulnerability. And so that's what I mentioned in the meditation, a kind of forgiveness that life includes pain. Forgiveness of life for including pain. Forgiveness of life for the fact of our vulnerability. And then in a way, the vulnerability is freed from its vulnerability. And we find the fact of love, not as any particular emotion or something, but the fact of love, the fact. So when people say it's our true nature, it's the nature of what is, it's the nature of things, that there is not separateness. And so we can be so moved and we can care so much. So just like, let's say this morning, if you were in the movement, we explored the lungs, and at some point we could feel the lungs and the heart. The lungs are just around the heart there. And the heart has its rhythm and the lung has its rhythm. And the lungs are not thinking the heart should slow down and the heart's not thinking that the lungs should hurry up and be like me. But they do affect each other. So on the exhale, the heart does slow down a little bit, especially if we're a bit relaxed. And on the inhale, the heart does speed up a little bit if we're relaxed. So they kind of sing to each other. And there's not a question of sort of, you know, I'm going to eat first and then you can have some. The heart always feeds itself and the lungs. And the lungs always feed the heart and the lungs. And so a couple of days ago, we talked about contact. We talked about that sort of basically continuity of substance, which we could also say a continuity of energy field, overlap of energy field, whatever way you want to try to think about it so that you're allowed to experience your experience better. So we can shift from that pointedness where out of fear and a feeling not enough, there's wanting in our behavior, in everything that, in the behavior of our system, in the way we think and what we say, what we don't say, etc. Where we walk, where we don't walk. Back to letting ourselves, so maybe out of rebelliousness, because we notice that it's not our nature to be so pointed and pushy. It's not our nature to know in that limited way. That doesn't fit us, to know what's right. But we can feel how easily from the vulnerability that we feel hurt, and from hurt, we think that we need to feel that we're right and blame the other in order to stop feeling so hurt and ashamed of our hurt. So if you notice where the shame is, then that's really good to practice around there. When we feel ashamed, because we assume that there's this thing wrong with me that's wrong. It's something's wrong, and it's wrong with me and not you, or it's wrong with us and not them, or whatever. And how immediately we go towards some kind of blame and being right in order to not feel the shame. Which word is it?
Yeah.
You got it? Okay. If we come back to the vulnerability and then rather get pulled into the hum of loving what we love, the hum of delight or the hum of, sometimes we feel very uncomfortable, but we can still feel that hum, I guess, vibration of potential. Our potential to be what we love. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And then this practice of staying tuned to the hum of potential of what we love. So on this planet at this stage, we have the reminders of what's wrong. And the possibility, certainly the ideas that it's getting worse and worse, that the possibility that it maybe it is. Who's to, we don't know. But in all of that momentum towards fear, and then the focus on survival first, and then we'll live, to find this tiny thread humming from the inside that comes across to my system as loving anyway. So we could say loving life, but it'll be specific. It's a specific tune or tone or whatever for each of us. To just stay and stay and stay and come back and come back and stay and come back and stay and come back to the humming with that. And we can use our past experience of when you did experience your potential realized. That can help us keep going back to that. It's like a thread or the string of an instrument, but it hums from the inside. And we can make our body and mind vulnerable to that tone. So I often give this similar example, but I feel it's a good one. So, and for those of us who are in the singing in the evenings, you may have noticed that sometimes here, singing on retreat, by the time we've really just would normally stop singing, we've done. We've been singing for a couple minutes, and isn't that when the song changes? Or we fast forward or something. Really, what we've done is we've warmed up. And we're just starting. So when normally we would turn it off or turn to the next song or something, we've just started. And around that time, when we're just starting, there might come a little wobble, like a little moment where there might be a so-called mistake, again, that word. And it's almost as if the energy has built enough that it's wider than it was when we started. And something in us is together enough in the singing. We're breathing together. We're sounding together. We're maybe enjoying together. That suddenly the song finds that, oh, it could actually go bigger. And in that transition, there's a kind of, you might find that even though you knew the words, you said a different word, let's not call it wrong, came out of your mouth. Or you were clapping and the clapping did something different. And if we can be not bothered by that and even take it as a marker of a quantum leap in a small way, that we've actually come to match the frequency of the energy of our singing. And that keeps happening for a while, until then it goes quiet. And that can be really useful to notice right about the time when you think this should be done now, I'm done. It could be that it's about time for a mistake and a falling more open and feeling that the hum in a different way that's less me and my hum. And so then it might happen that it's like, even though we each have our different voices, but it somehow is a one voice. And then even the oneness of the voice falls apart. There's not a one anymore even. Just keeps getting more open. And it's sort of like then where, just as we could talk about continuous substance or continuous energy with waves passing through and we can feel objects from a distance and so on, as we talked about a few days ago, with the help of Jacques. Just as easily we could talk about it as being just space. And from just space, we can have a sensation of spaciousness. We can have an experience of emptiness, or the feeling that it's space rather than form. That it's not even one voice, it's not even a sort of organism with our voice as one anymore. There's no membrane, there's no wall holding it together. We're more vulnerable to another kind of space, ka, which is, we can say, space beyond space and time. That we can't, it's not touchable. But when we're vulnerable to that space beyond space and time, something completely unknown, unknowable, by enjoying what happens when it's not even me and my hum, it's more open, even more open, even more open. What seems to come up out of that, maybe we can call it deeper space. Can I call it deeper space? Yeah? What do you think?
Why not?
Why not? Okay. A word that comes out of there, so to speak, is a different animal. It's a different thing. So when there's not the trace of me and my hum, even, but something way bigger comes through in a word, we can have the sense that this word is different, experientially different from the other words. And the difference is that that word that really came out of nowhere has no pushiness in it, zero. At all. And that's why then our full love response can happen. So that conversation that I mentioned of Krishnamurti from a few days ago, where he keeps saying, yeah, but how are you going to know? How are you going to know that you're not just being influenced by someone who wants to influence you in a certain way, consciously or unconsciously? And finally, in his own words, what he says after pages and pages of, yeah, but how are you going to know if you're that your intuition's not fooling you, etc. He calls it direct perception, the direct perception. So we're saying openness, and then life is allowed to come through and do for us without a plan, without a directedness, without a pointedness. So there can be that the word comes and it has a point to what is said has a point. It has a precision. Something definite could be said, but the quality of the words is not someone trying to make someone else do something. It's fully a gift. And so when we talked about sacredness, one of the small things I was considering in my very little knowledge of how people make sacred space sort of technically. People whose job is to make a sacred space, what they might do. And one of the things, one of the kind of practices would be that first there's a cleansing and then there's an offering. So in the presence of no demand, no influence, we can let our openness get, it goes more receptive. Because someone's not trying to make us be joyful. And we've been really doing what we can do to stop trying to make myself do what they told me to do, whatever it is. And so listening without our past, not interested in being influenced again. We can try make some experiments as best we can. We can make experiments of listening without the past. And our fear might be that if I don't have my past with me, I'll be vulnerable to influence. But let's try. If I listen without past, to my best way, best guess, there'll be some past. But best I can, listening without past. Not necessarily, I don't mean listening only to me, listening to the bird or to yourself, whatever. Listening without past. Not so that I'm more vulnerable to influence. Listening without past so that I'm more able to really hear where's their pressure and influence and where's their fully gift. And that could be that offering that comes. So we clear the space, there's the cleansing. And in so many ways, just by being still, just by being here, just by still being here after all these days, no matter what's happened in your meditation, or what hasn't happened, etc. So much cleansing happens. And it would be useful, so that's the kind of thing, that usefulness. It would be good use of being a bit cleansed. So we're rested, we've been in a rhythm, and there's certain energies in the body that need that rhythm to be at peace, so that our more spiritual capacity is a bit more ready. Available. So having been cleansed in so many different ways, just by having been here, allowing the deepest offering to happen from out of nowhere. And the kind of sweetness of that gift, out of nowhere, not I didn't buy it in any way, not by good behavior, not by good rebellion, in any way did I buy it. It just was completely given. And so then as my teacher, Punjaji, we called him Papaji, said, what else could you want to do? And it's that sort of being devoted to the openness that can then respond as falling more open and being interested in letting the energy gather rather than waste itself on watching myself, judging myself, pushing myself. We can feel how wasteful that is. And when we just stop wasting, we stop believing the observer. And we feel our way into that energy that would otherwise observe and distance and separate. The energy gathers and we can keep, the openness falls bigger, falls more open. And the gift can be complete, complete gift, completely given. very tempting to join in. So the forgiveness of our vulnerability for being so vulnerable, with all this contact, there's so much influence on each other. But we just go inside more and find that openness is less afraid of the hurt that can happen, is less interested in making the hurt more, which is one of our main activities, is that we make what hurts hurt more, with shame and blame and so on, taking it personally, etc. And here's where it's a real experience that not only can we kind of deal with the fact that hurt happens, our energy is released to protect, to be as protective as possible of all, and it's still maybe not our main occupation. There's still a staying steady with what isn't hurtable, that hasn't ever been hurt. And I think this is a tricky part for us because of not trusting. So in the state of not trust, we feel loyal to the hurt. And the fact that there's some part of me that's not hurt by that devastation is scary. It's as if there's something saying it wasn't so devastating. And when we're really staying steady with what's not hurt, it's nearly the opposite. We can really feel the hurt clearly. We can really see how it was unnecessary. And then we can stay true to that potential of non-harming. We're really devoted to that potential of staying with that, the hum, the thread of the hum of life. So tuning to that thread that hums with life. Sometimes, as I described that when I went back to the Bodh Gaya retreats with more joy, can start to discern two kinds of restlessness or unease or trouble. So there can be, partly with the help of the beautiful meditation, with the help of wherever you find it easier to just really be in the joy or the happiness or the lightness, to let that be given, to let it have you. And out of that naturally will come an unease, which is really healthy. It's not the same old, isn't this song over yet? Can't we get to the next song kind of thing? So exactly having stayed through what would have been the end of the song and the beginning of the next one, and fallen into deeper and more open. There's an undeniable restlessness. So Jayaji gave the example of feeling rebellious against the pressure to be joyful. It's a healthy restlessness with a misunderstanding, miseducation, hitting a programming that is ready to be pushy and obedient. Is there any question?
I was thinking about the concept you were saying, while you're being, let's say, attacked by your mind.
Yeah.
And then you kind of being tuned to this hump that you were saying. So I was thinking about this kind of concept and also the concept of surrendering, because for me it's very difficult to feel this hum once my mind is there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I try to surrender, just to say, okay, I can't do anything.
Yeah.
I just can't do it. And so I was thinking how these two can be blended somehow.
In a way, it's the same thing, because what we're tuning to is not something that we're making up. So surrendering is giving up the project of anything to do with the survival strategy. So the mind is going crazy with anger or fear or whatever. And I tried to intervene and that made it worse. And it's this failure thing. So then, okay, I notice that by touching it, it's not. Nothing is helpful is happening. And so I stop touching it. It, in a way, by non-resisting, I've actually unplugged the programming. I'm coming out of the against-ness, which is the root of the whole thing. In a way, I'm acknowledging my vulnerability. I can't do this. And then because we're not trying to go from one doing to another doing, we're going from an unnecessary doing to what is. So by surrendering, then if it happens, we land with what is. On the other hand, I'm not saying it's easy, and I am saying it's worthwhile to find that quality of love that's tuning through, even the window is so dirty, but you could see the light or something through there. You could see the way the tree is moving in the breeze or something. You can just barely see it. That's also worthwhile. But if we can actually have the two examples, it's very helpful. Thank you. I'm not trying to just do harder, tuning to the hum harder and harder. Sometimes for a short period of time, that could be worthwhile. But if we can surrender, great, because then we're just landing with really not my imagined version of the string humming with the light, you know, it's like actually landing with my. Something more? Niyogi?
Can you ask something about the survival strategy you spoke about? Maybe it's about the terms in English, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
The difference between approval and acknowledgement.
I think that I said recognition rather than acknowledgement. But so acknowledgement might be, if we weren't in silence, coming into the room, and I might acknowledge your presence just by looking at you, or you might acknowledge my presence by saying hello. But we haven't said anything about whether we approve of each other. Then approval, it would be more towards, I really smile at you. I like you. Acknowledgement is is I accept that you exist.
That's not, it's not a part of the survivalist tradition, the want of...
Sure, it could be. Definitely. Maybe there's a feeling that if I don't know that everybody in the room knows I'm here, you can like me or not, I don't care. That kind of thing. But you got to know I'm here. I don't want you to approve, but I want you to... Okay, so I just want to end with a poem. Which is going to take me a moment to find, because I had a different poem. Ready? So some of you have heard this poem before, but I hope you like it as much as I do, maybe, to hear it again. It feels like poem of the day. It's by Wendell Berry, American poet, U.S. poet. It doesn't have a title. The cherries, do you know what cherries are? What are cherries in Hebrew? Little, small, usually red.
Okay.
The cherries turn ripe, ripe. And the birds come. Red-headed and red-bellied woodpeckers. Blue jays, it's a kind of bird. Cedar waxwings, another kind of bird. Robins, another kind of bird. Beautiful, hungry, wild. In our domestic tree. So domestic is like home. I pick with the birds, gathering the red cherries alight among the dark leaves, my hands so sticky with juice, the fruit will hardly drop from them into the pail, into the bucket. But it's the word pail. The birds pick as I pick, all of us delighted in the weighty heights. The fruit red ripe, the green leaves, the blue sky and white clouds, all tending to flight, making the most of this sweetness against the time when there will be none. And you are to me, my love, as a tree of ripe cherries. And I am a wild bird high in your branches, hungry, ready to fly. You can put that to music.
What's the name of the poem again?
Wendell Berry. B-E-R-R-Y.
That's helpful. Cherries and berries.
Yes. So just a small thing to say about the poem. I don't want to say much for now, but maybe we'll come back to it another day. But just that Wendell Berry is a farmer as well as a poet and activist. And so just in our exploration of what are we doing and what is this effortless thing that Pramaji so kindly and beautifully brought up yesterday.
Is this what thing?
what are we doing and what is this effortless thing? So openness and letting life do it. So he's got this cherry tree that he's grown and he's sharing it with the wild birds. And so there can be a harmony of what we're kind of called to do, like going to the interview with the teacher, even though it's going to kill you, but it doesn't. So the way that that humming string pulls us out of the confines of our strategy, of our survival, of our belief in survival at all, that we should be surviving rather than something a completely different way. So how it can be like wherever the fruit is, whatever the season is, whether you grew the tree, you helped grow the tree. So there can be quite some work involved, but really the most magic of it is not what we did. So walking along the paths with these little baby trees, as Pramaji was pointing out yesterday, that Varshaji's going with the bucket of water every day. And no one has been doing that all these years. So it's so lovely to have that energy of someone actually taking the bucket of water. And then the tree itself can use the water so well. And then we can enjoy what comes off the tree, comes in the tree. And be a movement of love that enjoys, that gets sticky. That's practice. Anything else to say, ask, share, comment? In the darkening day. May all beings be at peace. With a heavy bucket in a high tree. With the wild birds. Letting our hurts and our vulnerability rest in the care of what's untouchable. What cares enough to rebel and to be still and to love, to hum, to fall open. And may we devote ourselves, our lives, our practice to that falling open, to allow the momentum towards liberation for all, including ourselves.